Welcome to the Radiant Springs Church Podcast. Check out our website at radiantsprings.com for more information about us. If you are challenged with what you hear on this podcast, come join us on Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock for our contemporary worship, message, fellowship, and coffee. Radiant Springs. Refreshing, relevant, real.
Hey, well, good morning, everybody. Your pastor gave it away. I do not have a North Dakota accent, and neither do I have a Nebraska accent. And actually, even when you talk about football, I'm sorry to admit, I don't really know all of that much about what you're talking about, because I grew up in a part of the world where we play rugby. And if you don't know what that is, it's football for real men. You know, we don't put helmets on. We don't pad up. We just go in. If you survive the game, you win. You know, everybody's a winner in rugby as long as you survive. If you live to the end, it doesn't matter which team comes in at first, everybody's a winner. But really great to be with you, and special to be able to share this occasion. Great to see the format of your church and just the great way in which you're fellowshipping. I don't know about you, but my heart always longs for community. It's just part of the way in which we wire it, the way in which we put together. And so to get together around tables, even on Sunday morning, is a good thing. And it's great to be able to share this morning with you. I'm traveling alone, which isn't what I normally do. I normally have my wife, Carol, with me, and she sends her greetings. We were in touch this morning, not by AT&T that I discovered does not have a presence in your town, but we were Skyping together, and she's got all kinds of responsibilities. She's spearheading a brand new initiative at Trinity Bible College, and that is to launch two master's programs by next year. For the first time in the history of the school, we'll have a graduate program going, and that's really exciting. I want to do three things today. The first one is I would love to tell you a little bit about what's going on at Trinity. Just keep you up to date, get you to pray for us, get you involved, get you starting conversations, ask you to make some phone calls, get a hold of somebody, say, hey, we heard the president of Trinity Bible College. Stuff's happening there. It's good news, and we'd love to start some conversations. So I'd love to do that for a few moments. I'll tell you a little bit about our book, and I'm passionate about that because we wrote it for a very specific reason. And then I'd love to just sort of wrap the whole thing up around this missions theme by sharing a few thoughts from God's Word. So three things, you know where we're going. I've heard that there is chicken breast on the grill, so I'm really well motivated to finish this all up just as well as you are, and give me that opportunity. You know, in amazing circumstances, seriously amazing circumstances, Carol and I found ourselves coming back to America. We've had a presence in America, a home in America. Our family been in America for 12 years. But about 8 years ago, well, 9 years now, we found ourselves being asked to lead the Assemblies of God College and graduate school in the United Kingdom. It was an amazing privilege. We saw the school grow and expand. We trained people literally from all over Europe. And about a year ago, this month exactly, we began to feel just that sense. The wind has changed. You know, call whatever metaphor you like. The roots have been loosened on the tree. And we knew that something was starting to develop that would ultimately lead us back to this amazing nation of the United States. And we became so convinced of that we actually began to process an exit, and we negotiated for a 7 month or 6 month sabbatical where we were able to do some writing and some dreaming and some praying and just the kind of stuff that we needed to refresh ourselves. And we returned to the United States not knowing what the next step was, where we were going, in December of last year. And an adventure began. We'd had lots of conversations. We knew that potentially there were lots of doors open to us. But we knew that God was also putting together something that we couldn't have orchestrated or planned. And in January, we received a little email and said, would there be any possibility that you'd come and do a spiritual emphasis week for Trinity Bible College in Ellendale, North Dakota? And so, first of all, I had to sort of remind myself where North Dakota was, and then I did a Google Map search, and it spent a very long time trying to find where Ellendale was, because it's a very tiny little community down in the southeast of North Dakota. And I must admit, my first inclination was, Who on earth would plan to win a Bible college in Ellendale? And all I can conclude is that God's got much more intelligence than most of us. Somehow, some way, he knows what he's doing, and we're discovering that. And so we agreed to do that. We had some commitments of services over in Illinois, and I turned to my wife. I said, what about going up there? It's only about a day's journey. Now, this is January. January, North Dakota. We're coming from North Carolina, and we get driving, and I start to think that maybe even Christopher Columbus didn't feel as though he was going as far away as what we were going. You know, I convinced myself, 20 more miles, we're going to fall off the edge of this. This is like a tabletop. This is flat. This has got to come to an end. And it never came to an end, not for the first hour, not for the next 5 hours, not the next 10 hours. And eventually we rolled into very bleak Ellendale, minus 19 degrees, and we got out there. And we had one of those strange moments that sometimes you have in your Christian life where it just doesn't all add up. You know, this kind of sense of why on earth am I here, but I know that I need to be here. You know, that paradox that sometimes God does that. I think that's why we're going to have all of eternity, because we've got so many questions to ask God. I don't know about you, but I got lots of questions to ask God. Why does he do things the way that he does? And then when we look back, just like the Bible says, we're able to say this is the Lord's doing, and it was marvelous in our eyes. By the second day, we were speaking in chapel. We were doing some input to the faculty. And we then discovered that there was an executive committee of the Board of Trustees that had turned up. I got slightly suspicious. I didn't think that they were there just for the spiritual emphasis. And eventually we were ushered into a little room and a conversation began. And the end of the conversation was, would we consider the presidency of Trinity Bible College? It was not on my bucket list to live in Ellendale, North Dakota. And I very quickly discovered the Trinity Bible College had had a few tough years. And as we drove away, it was just one of those moments again where we knew somehow, some way, we were committed to this thing. Let me share just two things that I hope you will get a bit of a heartache like I have a heartache. If you haven't discovered, our nation is changing and changing dramatically. Your town is changing. The way in which your industries begin to recruit workers, that's changed. Now, it was even 10 years ago. And we've gone through a dramatic and radical social and cultural shift. So radical is that shift, friends, that some of us don't even know quite how to handle it. Do you know that right now in California, it's illegal for a kindergarten teacher to stand up and address the children in her kindergarten class by saying, "Good morning, boys and girls." That's illegal. You cannot do that in California because somehow the legislators believe that by addressing them by gender-specific terms, you might enforce upon them a gender orientation that they don't really want. So you can only address children in a classroom environment in California by saying, "Good morning, children." It's got to be gender neutral. And we sit here in the heartland of America and we say, somebody was off the wall. Somebody was in an ivory tower and did not know what they were doing. But actually, it's not as simple as that, because there are massive forces driving our culture. There are subtle forces that drive the way in which legislation is put together, the way in which people are put into social services and educational environments, and it is an agenda that is often called secular humanism. We've lived right in the heart of it. We've lived in the cathedrals of secular humanism in Europe. We've spent time in the university cities. We ran a Bible college in the center of Cambridge, in the heart of ancient learning in the United Kingdom. And I need to tell you, friends, that these forces are extraordinarily powerful, and they are undermining and seeking deliberately to undermine many of the values that we hold dear, not just as Christians, but actually just as heartland Americans. The sort of stuff that defined our culture for two centuries is now being swept away really rapidly. And as we've moved around the nation, we've discovered that there are many, many Christian leaders who don't know how to handle it. Don't know how to handle this cultural shift. We looked at this in the United Kingdom and we discovered that over 60% of the pastors in churches just like this had no idea how to handle what was going on culturally. They hadn't read any books, they hadn't been prepared to handle it, and they were really confused. And as a result, here's the key, many, many churches like this church, you're an exception. To see these kids in here is fantastic, but many churches like this church all across America, and especially heartland America, have now become what I call generationally terminal. In other words, they're going to die with the generation that's currently in there. This generation that is currently in the church is getting older every single year, and it's only probably 15 or 20 years before we will lose many of our churches just by generational end, coming to an end. And I don't know about you, but that's tragic to me. I think these lighthouses of faith, these great places of community that we've got, we ought to have them on in every town. We ought to have three or four in every town, and yet we find that the churches are flatlining. They are not reaching the migrant communities that are coming through. They are losing the next generation. And we feel we want to be a part of the answer to that. We want to be a part of the answer. Let me mention one more thing, and then we'll tell you how we believe we can be part of the answer. The other thing is this, friends. I've lived on the other side of the fence. I grew up in South Africa. I saw the work of American missionaries. And you know what the double whammy of churches stalemating, flatlining, losing their influence? Do you know what the double whammy of that is? The double whammy is that the single biggest resource for world mission, I'll say that again, the single biggest resource for world mission that has ever existed ever in the history of the church, more than the Jerusalem church, more than the Ephesian church, more than the Roman church, more than any other era of church history, genuine evangelism, world evangelism, reaching into towns and villages across the world. The single biggest resource was the evangelical church of the United States of America in the 20th century. You have no idea how your nation has blessed this world. Blessed countless millions of people around the globe. Some of the most intrepid missionaries that have been produced have come right out of states like yours and churches like yours. And as churches begin to flatline, do you know what the next impact is, tragically, is that that resource for world missions is gone. I speak to missionary after missionary, and they say, we can't even get services anymore, let alone find financial support for our future. It's just really tragic. And Carol and I have arrived in this part of the world, and we have a heartache for churches and a heartache for the mobilization of mission. And as we have looked at it all, just because it's the sort of primary gift that we have, we are convinced that one of the ways we can reverse that trend is by having a vibrant Bible college. Well, let's not even call it that. I like to call it a kind of apostolic. Those are big Bible words, but they've all got rich concepts behind them. A sort of apostolic prophetic thinking center. Places where people can think and talk and imagine and dream. And chapel by chapel, people are sharing the needs of the world. And we have individuals coming from Asia and Africa and talking about orphans and widows and people who are outside of grace and being able to inspire men and women to say, I'll do anything that I can. I'll give all that I have for the cause of the kingdom. That's what Bible colleges can do. And in our group of churches, do you know that we have only two Bible colleges? As of this next summer, we will only have two functional Bible colleges left. We've mutated all of them into liberal arts universities. And I celebrate Christian higher education. I did my whole PhD in areas related to that. But friends, there are certain things that can be achieved in Bible colleges that are very difficult to achieve in a multiversity, not a university, because universities really become multidisciplinary centers. And so we're passionate. And here we are, right in the middle of the Great Plains, a little place called Trinity. We currently have about 220 students. We need to get a whole lot more than that. Our capacity is a whole lot larger. But just in the last 3 months, I wish I could bring you on a quick journey. I wish you could come and share. Do you know that by the middle of the summer, we were able to entirely restaff the entire upper echelon of the school? We've gathered world-class people. I am serious about this. This isn't rhetoric. People, I have worked in institutions all around the world. The people that are in the upper leadership levels of Trinity Bible College, I honestly would be able to say to you, I would gladly work with them anywhere in the world. They are high-class individuals. We're restructuring many aspects of the program. Chapel services are vibrant and alive. We're mobilizing students into mission trips all around the world, and there are all kinds of things happening. And I just want you to know that we're excited to be there. We're excited at what God's doing, And we believe that this part of the world can become one of the great examples to the rest of the nation of what it is to have a sustainable and viable Bible college right in the heart. You're kind of getting that. You're kind of staring at me, and I know that, but you did have an extra night's sleep, so you ought to be more awake than before. You know, I almost gave you an excuse there. You have no excuse. You ought to be excited with me, and I hope that you're getting a little bit of our excitement at what God is doing. So please pray for us. Please speak to your seniors in high school. It's a phenomenal way. And by the way, we are a Bible college, but we're a Bible college with some amazing, what I call complementary disciplines. So let me share one of them. It's just the most amazing arrangement. We have an articulation agreement with Valley City State University, a great, well-established state university in North Dakota, been around for 100 years. And do you know that a student can now come to Trinity in the environment of a Bible college with all of that input and motivation and worldview that they're able to develop? In 4 years, they're able to graduate at no very little extra cost. They're able to graduate with 2 degrees, a Bible college degree, a bachelor's, and a Bachelor of Science in Education. They can do teacher ed at the same time and graduate with elementary ed and physical ed. I mean, that's the most amazing context and environment in which to do it. And that's available right now. We're in full delivery of that program. We have a great business faculty as well. We have an intercultural studies program that we believe is going to become second to none. And there are all kinds of other exciting options that are available at Trinity Bible College, a great campus, well developed. We've just opened $500,000. In fact, I reckon it's close to $1 million. Fitness center that some kind people gave to us over the summer. Just state-of-the-art fitness center, probably one of the best gymnasiums in North Dakota. In fact, I know that our basketball floor is the best floor in North Dakota. It's better than the state university. Well, I'd better stop. I'm going on and on. We are launching a really innovative program called Pack Your Bags. This is launching next fall. Do you know, we've got a generation now that leave high school, and because of the way in which our society has mutated and the way in which business has worked and the way in which regulation has come down to us, we've got a whole generation that largely are not really sure what they want to do when they leave school. They're the few that leave school and know exactly which way they want to go, but there are huge numbers of school leavers who don't really know what they need to do, what they got to do. So they go off to college, and do you know that right now, statistically, in the United States, the average student is spending nearly 2 semesters more in college getting their first degree than what they have to? In other words, spending almost a year longer, because they'll get into 2 years, then they'll transfer, and then they'll find that this credit doesn't transfer, and they've got to find another credit. It's kind of like building a Lego set, and any parent that's getting involved in trying to get their kids through school, they know that that's the case. And I think that that's unnecessary. I think that by preparing people better, we can enable them to streamline their way through, and perhaps even with a bit of summer work and just loading their credits, could get through college in as little as 3.5 years. That's possible if you do it well. And so what we've done is we've launched a program called Pack Your Bags. It is a pre-college program. It's not accredited. There's no study allowance. There's no financial aid that's available for it. But we think it'll be a phenomenal year of your life. Students will come to Trinity. They'll have the security of the senior administration and the structure of the school. But we've appointed a phenomenal young couple who are now the directors, Jordy and Elizabeth, of this program. And we will bring our students in. The first thing we do is we put them in vans. And I can tell you, we are finding places where, I found one right here in Crete where AT&T don't have a service, but we will take them to where they cannot use their cell phones, they cannot use their iPads, they cannot stick things in their ears and just pretend that the rest of the world doesn't exist. And we will start with some real great input in terms of life skills and bring them back onto the campus. And the first phase is a life skills phase, just really helping young people understand how life works, understand relationships, understand finance, understand time, understand how college works. And then on the back of that, we pack them all in the vans again. We go off to the Twin Cities, or actually potentially even down to Omaha, Nebraska. We've got some connections with some amazing inner city ministries. And for 2 weeks, we'll scrub floors and we'll serve in soup kitchens. And who knows, when somebody who's 18 years old does that, suddenly their bedroom back home looks a whole lot better than what it used to be. And mom's cooking is just outstanding. And And, you know, they just start to get a new sense of values. We'll bring them back out of that. And then we start a ministry phase. We'll actually teach young people how to share their testimony, how to do little drama, or maybe even if they've got some musical skills, we'll tap into that. We will do that. We'll enable them. And then we jump on an airplane and we go to South Africa for 6.5 weeks, area we're very familiar with. In fact, I'll be there in 2 weeks' time, partially setting this program up. We will work with widows and orphans, home-based AIDS care. We will be working in a number of after-school programs. We'll go out with mobile clinics and we'll help serve medical people in that. I can tell you now, I've done this for years. Every young person I ever take on that trip, they come back, their lives are forever changed in the best possible way. Just incredibly fills their hearts with a sense of passion. We will fly back from that. We'll have a little Christmas break and then we'll go into a Bible phase. We'll actually teach kids that there are two parts of the Bible. How novel is that? You know, there's an Old Testament and a New Testament, and they both belong together in the same Bible, and they're interconnected, and there's a reason why they're there. And we will actually do that kind of basic Bible introduction. And then after that phase of about 4 or 5 weeks, we all jump on an airplane again, and we go off, and we backpack across Israel. We kayak on the Jordan River. We walk where Jesus walked. We take them to the ancient sites. The Bible comes alive, will forever change their lives. And then we come back for an exit program, which is jam-packed full of career guidance, help them actually apply for the college of their choice, know how to do that, help them in terms of structuring their courses, and we'll have a great graduation day, and we'll send them off to serve Jesus for the rest of their lives. And that's called Pack Your Bags. Got some brochures there. It's not cheap, but hey, moms and dads and grannies and grandpas and uncles and aunts, let me say this to you. In the early 1960s, our nation resigned the responsibility of training the next generation to the federal government, and it is burdened generation after generation with massive debt burdens that never existed before when we were responsible for training our own children. And here I want a new culture to arise in the heartland that says, yeah, we'll get a little bit. We're already saving up for our grandkids to enable them to do a thing like this. And if you'd like to, you can get that. Now, I'm talking much too much. Let me give you just 2 seconds on our book. We wrote this book. Everywhere we went, people were saying to us, please, won't you write a book? We just want you to share some of that stuff with us. And then a number of things happened in our lives that we could never have planned for. 10 years ago, exactly this summer, our son was crossing a major intersection near our home in North Carolina. A 60,000-pound garbage truck traveling at 60 miles an hour came up and T-boned the side of his car. The impact was so great it literally sheared the wheels off the axles. His heart was thrown from this part of his abdominal cavity down to here, ruptured his aorta, and massive internal injuries, and the list goes on. It's a huge, long story. And just because I have sometimes done this and people don't concentrate on another word, I said, this January, our son Jason, who now lives in California, came off the last medication and is living a full and happy life. But just an amazing miracle of how God saw him through. And then about 5 years ago, another long story. I won't go into it, but I found out that I was eligible for some what's called a well man's exam. Isn't that an oxymoron? I mean, you can't get sick men to have an exam. How can you have well men to have an exam? You know, and so the insurance said I could go, and I didn't want to go, and so I lost the letter. And unfortunately, Carol found the letter, and she read it. Said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "Nothing, of course." And then she got that very feminine look that just is impossible to deal with if you're a male. And she said, "If you love me and you love the children, you know, that sort of thing, ladies, that's unfair. We were not created to live with that kind of stuff, you know." And so I ended up going, and I was in great shape, and they all said I was in great shape. And then they did a little scan, and somebody, one of the cardiologists said, oh, and I said, what? And that led to another scan, and then another scan, and then eventually they gave me a transesophageal scan. Does anybody know what a transesophageal scan is? Let me just tell you. I'll just help you if they ever tell you that. They get a video camera, they stick it on the end of a garden hose, and they ram it down your throat. That's what it is. And they have a big hairy nurse standing right next to you. It was a lady, and she keeps saying, hands, because you want to pull it in. This was in England where they don't put you out. They just, you know, they save money because you've got a national health system. They ram this thing down. You're gagging all the way through. And I discovered that day, and they discovered that I had a massive aortic aneurysm. that was about to pop. It was 5.6 centimeters in dilation. And they said, don't push a car, don't pick up a suitcase, don't do anything strenuous. And again, because of National Health, it took 10 months from that point to the point that I actually got surgery, and huge surgery, the most complicated they did in that part of the world. And whole big story. And you can see I survived. I came through it, and big, long story. And then, you know, just lots of other experiences of life. And we started to discover that God is just amazing. If you haven't found out that, I want you to know that. Some people, the only way they know God is through their favorite TV preacher. And that's not a good way to get to know God. You know, because all that you'll do is get to know God this much and how much to give him this much. You know, that's about all that happens in those contexts. And so we set to write what we called a comprehensive theology. In other words, helping people get a comprehensive view of just how great and special and good God is. And we write experiences from our mission lives and establishing schools of mission and reaching out to orphans and out of our own personal lives and Jason's accident. And all the way through, this is what we do. We simply say, here is a theological thought. It's found in the Old Testament. It's taught in church history, something like that. Anybody can read it. And then we say, this is how we learned it. So we share narrative, story. And then right at the end, Carol, who had done her PhD at that stage, went back and she had a very big comprehensive bibliography. And she wrote endnotes to say, if you want to read more about this, these are the books we want to recommend. So it could take you on a huge journey if you're into reading. But they're there, and these help us to get to Africa and do all sorts of things. So they're $15 at the back. Now, by now, most people would have finished preaching and we'd all be going home, right? Could you handle it a little bit more? Just encourage me a little bit. Just a little bit more. We're getting on all right. You're understanding my accent? That's good. That's great. Some people prefer not to understand my accent, but we're getting on great. There are three fascinating stories found in the Gospel of Luke. Luke was a doctor, by the way. He was trained in the Greek system of education, not the Hebrew system of education. And the Greeks had a very big issue on what they called empirical research. That's why we get people like Pythagoras and those who wrote those big, complicated equations that nearly made me fail school completely. You know, just seriously complicated stuff. And he was trained in that, and so his whole training made him want to find things out. And so an individual gave him a scholarship. You can read about this in the first book of Acts, and said, Luke, I want you to do some research. And he actually wrote a treatise or a thesis. And that's how the book of Acts starts out. And the thesis was written in two volumes, which was the way in which the Greeks structured their works. And the first volume we find is the Gospel of Luke. And so this wealthy man who commissioned him said, Luke, I've heard stories about a virgin conceiving. Is this possible? And so Luke wanted to make sure that this wasn't just some kind of religious hearsay. And so he actually did the research. And whilst Paul was imprisoned in Jerusalem, at the end of the missionary journeys, Luke went all around that region and he found eyewitness reports. And he wrote out of his very careful methodology how to just what he had discovered about Jesus. So that's why Luke and Acts are important books in the Bible. And Luke chapter 15, he records three interesting stories that Jesus told. And I want to share those stories with you. But in order to understand them, you actually have to understand where Jesus told those stories. So this is where I really need you to use the extra hour of sleep that you had to get your brains really working. Are you going to help me now? Just really cooperate, friends. I want you to imagine a map up behind me. And right in the middle of the map, there's a kind of a harp shape, which is the Sea of Galilee. Some of you might even check this out when you get home, make sure that I got it right, because there are normally some nice maps in the back of your Bible. They're not inspired parts of the Bible. They're just helpful little additions to the Bible. And there's this map. There's a sea called the Sea of Galilee. It's got a slightly harp shape. And right on the northern point of that seashore, you're still getting the picture there, there was a significant town, quite a big town. And the town was called Capernaum. It was a trading town. It was quite a rich town. And Capernaum had a kind of a rise going up from the seashore. You still with me? A rise going up to a small hill. And on top of the hill was a very prominent building called a synagogue, where the Jewish people would go to read the Torah and to worship. And because it was in a kind of a culturally changing time, they actually decided to build the synagogue with Corinthian columns, big columns, kind of like you see in, you know, the Capitol building. Not quite on that scale, but kind of getting, you know, those big columns at the front. And then you'd come down out of the synagogue, down some stairs, and then you had the main road that went from the synagogue all the way down to the edge of the sea. You still got a picture there? And then there was an intersection right there. And at that intersection, you had a road that was going east-west. And that road kind of bent around the sea, and it went down to the eastern side to a region where there were 10 cities called the Decapolis, the 10 cities down to the one side. And the other side actually came down and was a trade route out to the very fertile plains around Carmel. And if you went a little bit further south, you got to where Jesus was born in Nazareth. And so this was a big, busy road. But actually, the main road coming down from the synagogue didn't actually stop at that intersection. It continued on, and it became a fishing pier. And it went out into the Sea of Galilee. So you got this crossroads where you got a fishing pier going out into the sea, the main road up to the synagogue, and then the east-west road, which was the main arterial, the big main road where all the trade was done. You got that picture? And shrewdly, right there at that crossroads, right there, there was a man who set up a tax booth, kind of like a modern-day toll booth, if you like. I mean, how clever was that? So nobody could sell a fish without paying tax. Nobody could move their goods without paying tax. Nobody could go up to the market in the main street without paying tax. He was right there. What a lucrative business. I mean, clever man that he was. He said it right. His name was Matthew, and we get to know him in the Bible. In fact, he eventually wrote a whole story about Jesus in the Bible. And Matthew knew how to do his business well because he was employed by the imperial forces of Rome, who were hated people. They were colonists. They were hated by everybody. And so not only was he hated because he was employed by Rome, but he was also hated because he creamed off more than what he needed to take. And that's how he became an extremely wealthy man, very wealthy. I mean, it wasn't worth much because everybody hated him. He didn't have much of a social life, but he had lots of money. So, you know, we've had those kinds in almost every generation of human history. The unpopular rich who have got that way by exploiting others. And one day, Jesus, who spent a lot of time in Capernaum, goes up to Matthew, and just sort of the way he might say it today, he looks at Matthew, he says, Matthew, I can see a lot of potential in you. I wondered if you would like to join my ministry team. Now, just get this in context. Just try and understand this. It would be kind of like your pastor here going and standing outside the gates of your local high school. And he sees outside the gates of your high school is a guy dealing drugs. We all know what we think about those kind of people. You know, robbing your kids of their future, destroying their lives, exploiting the innocent. And he's dealing drugs with these kids pretty much in the open daylight. Kids are making choices that'll destroy their lives forever. And your pastor watches this transaction going on for maybe 1 or 2 hours, maybe 15, 20, 30 kids engaging the drug dealer. And then he goes over to the drug dealer and he says, buddy, it looks like you've got a real good way with teenagers. I wonder if you'd consider being my youth pastor. How well would that go down? I don't think that'd get the vote in a meeting. But it was just as radical, almost just as radical, for Jesus to go to Matthew and say, Matthew, I want you to join my team. And people were confused. Matthew was overwhelmed. He said, really? He said, I couldn't think of anything better. I've seen your work. I've seen your miracles. And Matthew closed up shop and he invited Jesus to a party. Now, Matthew had enough money to throw some pretty serious parties. And Jesus didn't seem to have a problem. It was the wrong side of the railway line. It was the place of the town where you would never want your daughters to go. But hey, Jesus was happy to go. And so Jesus goes down straight into Matthew's house. And Matthew's house is filled with all the kind of people that only Matthew could entertain. I mean, these are pretty seriously bad people in the community. The Bible sort of nicely calls them sinners. But they were just not nice people. You know, they were just the seedy part of society. And Jesus doesn't seem to have a problem at all going into that context. But there are two groups of people who didn't want to go in there at all. And so they gathered outside the door when the party was going on. The one group was Jesus' disciples, the ones who were already in place. They thinking, Jesus, what's going on? We wouldn't go in there for anything. We're good, self-respecting Jewish people. We grew up in good homes. Our mothers told us not to do this kind of stuff. We're not going in there. So they stand outside saying, maybe it was the heat of the day that's got to Jesus. Just, I mean, that's what happened. They weren't especially religious type people. They were just raw fishermen. And then there was another group that came. They were kind of semi-professional religious types. I mean, doesn't that just sound dangerous? You know, religious sounds dangerous, but semi-professional religious. People who get all hung up on being religious. Spend all of their money buying tapes and books and shooting off to conferences just because they sort of tied into a religious bent of mind. And they're always minoring on small issues and always tied up, and they're always getting the latest little tract. They're always trying to give you every sort of latest little bit of literature and trying to convert you to their way of thinking. Life's too short to get all complicated about your religious experience like that. These people in the Bible were called Pharisees. They were wealthy, self-supporting, and just obsessed with being religious, obsessed with what does God think about what to eat in the morning or in the afternoon, or I mean, just boring stuff. And they're outside, both of them, and they're talking to each other, the disciples and the Pharisees, and saying, the Pharisees saying to the disciples, what's going on with your teacher? How can he go in then? And for the first time ever, the disciples actually say, we don't know what's going on. We don't understand him at all. And Jesus is on the inside of the house. He's having the time of his life. This is just why he was born. It's just great. He's with people, giving them dignity and respect. Matthew cannot believe that somebody of Jesus' stature has actually spent some time. And all of the friends of Matthew say, Matthew, what did you do to get Jesus here? This is just amazing. Never thought he'd come into your home. And Jesus looks around. He says, where are the boys? And none of them are there. He says, did I leave them behind somewhere? So he goes outside, and there they are, having this discussion with the Pharisees. So what's up, boys? We're having a great time. The food's good. And they say, we're not going in there. Jesus says, why? That's not what we're going to do. We don't associate with people like that. And all the Pharisees are nodding their heads saying, well, at least they know something that you should know. Jesus said, you don't associate. Then he looks over at the Pharisees and says, what about you? Oh, no, they weren't going in there. No way. Because actually, a Pharisee going in there would feel contaminated. They would literally have to take their clothes and wash the sin germs off their clothes. That's how they'd wash their hands, not for sanitation, but to get rid of the sin germs. That's what happens when you get religious. It's dangerous. And so they don't want to go. So Jesus says, you don't want to come in here. What's wrong? No, we're not going in there. They say, oh, Jesus says, you probably need some help. They said, yeah, we don't understand you. He says, I'll tell you what. And he tells three stories. And in the next 5 or 6 minutes, I want to tell those stories as Jesus might have told them. First story, he says, there was a farmer, and he came in at the end of a day's work, and he started to count off his sheep. And he got to 90, and then 95, and then 96, and then 97, 98, 99. And there should have been 100, but one was missing. And intriguingly, Jesus says, he shut those found sheep in the pen, and he went out looking for the one lost sheep. And even more intriguing, when he found the one lost sheep, he got more excited about the one that was lost and found than the 99 that were never lost in the first place. And the Pharisees and disciples look at Jesus and say, huh? Why? And you know, the Pharisees were people of relative wealth, probably had some farming background. They said, every farmer loses a sheep now and again. In fact, I had a great uncle who was a sheep farmer, and I remember him telling me, sheep are the most Christian animals on the planet. He said, they die for no reason whatsoever. So they're always ready to die. Christians are always ready to die, right? We know where we're going. And so they say, you don't understand, sheep die. Sheep get taken. Something happens. Anybody in business knows that you're going to have some losses. You're making a delivery and the tire goes flat, or something falls off the shelf, or something goes rotten in the storage. You know that in business there's always going to be a certain amount of loss. Jesus, we don't understand your story about this one lost sheep. And Jesus turns on them, stares them out, and says, that's exactly why you don't understand me. That's the point. The point is that God sent me to this planet because there are lost people and every one of them counts. There's not one that's more important than another. There's not one that's born with greater stature and so should be cared for more than the other. Every single one counts. And friends, until you understand that, and I understand that, a lot about Jesus won't make any sense. A lot of who Jesus is and what Jesus wants to do in our lives actually won't be accomplished, because we've got to understand, somehow get this into our thinking, that as nice as this service is today, and as good as it is that we're all gathered and we can drink nice coffee and have nice handouts or whatever else church does, actually this isn't it. This isn't it. This isn't why we exist. The only reason we exist is to align ourselves with the cause of Jesus for those that aren't here. And church becomes a monstrosity and a distortion if all that it does is concentrate on the fat found sheep instead of the one that's lost. And it's only when churches orientate themselves to lost people that even church starts to make sense. I meet many hurt Christians, people who feel let down by the church. It's going to happen, friends, just part of being this side of heaven. But let me tell you, when there's a passion that starts to go heart to heart amongst the people who are Christ followers in a community that says we actually believe that we exist to help men and women and boys and girls who are lost, who don't know Jesus, who don't understand life, to find Christ, that's when church starts to make sense. And I hope your church will always be a church that prioritizes budget and effort and energy and passion and prayer for lost people. So that's how Jesus works. One lost person. Well, the disciples and the Pharisees, they just say, we don't get it. Still don't get it, Jesus. Jesus says, you still don't get it. I'll tell you another story. It's always dangerous when Jesus tells stories, because they pretty much cut to the bone. He says, there was a girl who lost a coin. We read that in the 21st century, say, big deal. You know, we could lose a whole bunch and wouldn't be worth much. But that's not how it was back then. These coins were extremely valuable coins. In fact, some of those coins had probably been minted all the way back to the reign of King David, and they were kind of really valuable heirlooms that were passed down from grandmother to mother to daughter. And the deal was that this was sort of the family value was all tied up. They still have that in certain parts of the world. In parts of India, there are whole female lines in families, and they get 24 karat gold, and they try to accumulate, and they pass it on. A kind of a sense in which they're saying, you're an extraordinarily valuable person, and whoever gets you gets a real good thing. My son-in-law has just had his 40th birthday party. My daughter spoiled him rotten, put on a wonderful party. Friends flew in. And I keep thinking to myself, I wonder if that boy just knows what a treasure he's got. I think he does, but he needs a bit of a slap around the face and a reminder every now and again. He's got my girl. My girl. She's a treasure, you know. And then these coins, what these girls would actually do is they would kind of embroider them into a headband. And they didn't have veils in those days, but they would put this headband on. And on the wedding day, they would actually wear this headband with all these coins in. And I don't know if they walked down the aisle, but my imagination goes, the mother would sort of coach the daughter and say, now listen, when you get to those in-laws, I want you just to stop it, you know, and shake those coins a little bit and just let those in-laws know what a precious treasure they're getting into their family. Just rub it in a bit, girl, is what the mother would say. I don't know, maybe you girls still have conversations like that with your daughters, but that's how it was, you see. And so these coins had lots of value. They spoke of family pride. They spoke of heritage. They spoke of the girl's value in her society. And this girl loses one of those coins. Devastating. So they all knew what Jesus was talking about. Does anybody remember the story? Do you remember what the girl did? Well, I can tell you this. She was a girl. I mean, she was a real girl. She started to get into every corner. She got a broom. She swept systematically. I can just imagine her making sure everything was in front of her, into every little dark corner, and swept out the house till she found it. Isn't that just like a girl? I mean, I'm telling you, I can't do that stuff. I'm just one of those males. I can't find things that were never lost. I don't know if that happens with men in Nebraska. I hope not. Ladies, I hope you've done better with your, but you know, I'll open the drawer and I'm looking for a pair of socks, say, you know, and I look in there and they're not there. I just don't know why they're not there. So I've been a chaplain in the military. So I think let's get a grid pattern going here. So I break the whole thing up into sort of 2-inch squares. I go from left to right. I go through every single grid. Then I go from top to bottom. And eventually in despair, I say, Carol, can't find the socks. You know where this is going, right? You have an idea. She walks from wherever she is on the other side of the house, walks straight into the room, puts her hand in the drawer, pulls him out. And I say, you had that in your pocket, didn't you? I mean, there's no way those socks were there just a second ago. How does that work? I don't get it. You know, it's actually a well-described syndrome. It's called domestic blindness. And it only afflicts the male of the species. I just don't know how yet. But here's this woman who's strategic. She's determined. She's going to find that coin. And Jesus says, that's a lot how it is with me fulfilling my Father's mission. This isn't hit and miss. This isn't hope for the best. Put on a church potluck and hope that maybe you'll turn up. Somebody will turn up. Turn on the lights and people will come. No. Lost people need to be found. There has to be a determination, a strategy, a commitment, an energy, a drive, offerings taken, pictures on the wall, reminders from time to time, just a constant commitment that everything we do, from raking lawns to giving to Convoy of Hope, all of it, friends, is that we are showing passion and commitment and energy and determination that we will not live selfishly pursuing our own goals in life. We are going to live deliberately fulfilling the mission of Christ, which is to find lost people. And I think what Jesus would say would be, if you don't get that, you're going to miss a whole lot else. That's when people get all tripped up on the color of the carpet and the paint on the walls. And I've been in church life enough to know that people do get upset about carpets and paints. And I say, get a life. Wake up. That's not what it's about. It's about lost people. Do you agree with me? Got time for one more story? Jesus says, I'll tell you one more story because it still doesn't seem like it's going home. These dull disciples and thick Pharisees. I'm going to tell you one more story. And he tells a story that contravenes all social norms if you understand it in its ancient context. It's sometimes easily read and not understood. You've got to understand it in first century. It's a story that we sometimes call the prodigal son. And it starts out with a boy coming to his father and literally saying, Dad, I wish you were dead. It's not a nice thing to say to your father anytime. But actually what he was saying is, I wish I didn't have to keep working on this family farm hoping that one day I'll get an inheritance. I'd like my inheritance now. And the father reads this and realizes he's got a challenge on his hand, and he does something that would seldom, if ever, happen, and that would have amazed especially the Pharisees, who were very, very astute in the way in which they handled money. And the father said, you don't have to wish that of me, son. I've got enough relative wealth in my family farm. I'm going to cut you your inheritance now. And so the son would have got a third. The older boy got 2/3. The younger boy got 1/3. That's how it was done back then. So quite a substantial bit of money. You know the story. The son goes out and he squanders his money in living a life that cheap money sometimes buys. And then one day all the money runs out and Jesus is looking at Pharisees. Now, if you know anything about Pharisees, they would not like to live in a town like yours that slaughters 10,000 hogs a week. In fact, they would not live here because they don't like bacon. And they don't eat bacon and they don't eat ham. And it's very much against their religion. And so Jesus kind of just rubs it in a little bit. He says, this boy got so hungry, he had to go and feed pigs. And the Pharisees, oh, that's the worst of worst. You know, they could. And Jesus saw them getting a little bit pale. And so he says, he even had to eat pig's swill, pig's food. Oh, the Pharisees, they're sick. And they had to run around the corner for a few minutes. And then Jesus says, the boy came to his senses and decided to go home. He had a well-practiced speech. I'm not worthy to be your son. I'll just become your hide. And the Pharisees are saying, never, never, you can't do that. That's not possible in our culture. If a boy does that, it's done. It's finished. In fact, they were so determined if a son did that, that they would actually take the last few things in that boy's room, they would put it in a small coffin, and they'd go out and they'll have a ceremonial burial. And they would say, this my son no longer lives. I will not think about him again. That's how determined they were when sons contravene the social norm that much. You've got to understand that from the context. But this father had something different about him. And he would be there and literally each day he would go out on the porch and something inside that dear heart of the father would look down and say, I don't know, I still think my son's alive. Do you think he'd ever come back and he'd ask himself? And then one day there's this little speck, tiny little speck out in the horizon. And everything in that father's heart jumps. And he thinks, just maybe. And the Pharisee's saying, no, please don't go on with the story. It's offending our culture. But Jesus goes on and he says, as the son came nearer, the father was determined. That was his boy. He recognized him. He recognized his step. And as he came into sight, that father did something that no self-respecting Middle Eastern man would ever have done. He reaches down. He gets the back hem of his robe. He pulls it up between his knees. And he takes off at a run, running towards his son, finds his son. His son still smells like pigs, but it doesn't matter because he has a father that loves. And he throws his arms around the boy and he says, son, the son of mine who was dead is now alive. And as he embraces his boy and this whole life is coming together, he looks back and there in the homestead, every window is open and there's somebody staring out of every window, a family member or a servant. And the father looks at them as if to say, what are you staring at? He says, go and get the robe. And all the eyes and all the faces in the window say, not the robe. Because the robe was kept for special guests who would come and actually contribute to the business of the family. Not for runaway children who smell like pigs. The father looks back with determination. He's the head of this house. He says, you bring the robe. And while you're about it, bring a ring. And also bring some sandals. This son of mine who was dead is now alive. And he's going to enter my home, not as some hired hand, but he's coming back as my son. He will come back to his rightful place. And get the fatted calf and kill that calf too. This son of mine who was dead is now alive. And he's coming back and being restored. Outstanding story. You know that story. But understand it in its context, it would have just blown those people. And Jesus looks right into their eyes and says, that's why I came. As long as there's a boy or a girl that's dispossessed in some way, some child living with no respect or some level of abuse, as long as there are boys and girls being peddled and traded as they are by their hundreds of thousands around the world right now, I'm committed to reach them and win them and restore dignity. There's a story in this book. It's the last chapter, and with it I close. When we established Africa School of Missions in South Africa, pretty much every night of our lives, we would put our kids to bed, and over the hills we could hear the beating of witch doctors' drums. If you've ever heard that, it's a confusing sound. It's actually quite hypnotic. And I remember when our daughter Anna, who's now given us our two beautiful grandkids, but when she was about 9, I remember Carol putting her to bed one night and she said, Mommy, where are those drums beating? They scare me. And her mom did her best to pacify her and said, it's okay, you're safe in our home. And then when I went to breakfast the next morning, I know my wife well enough, she gets a certain shade in her green eyes. And she said, Paul, it's not worth arguing when she's got that shade in her green eyes. She said, I married the queen of strong-willed women, and I love her for it. And she said, I'm going to find where those drums are beating. I said, you go ahead, darling. And I went off to work. It was always our practice to meet together for lunch. I came down across the campus, down the little stairs, into our home. I looked into the kitchen where Carol always had a nice lunch prepared for me. She wasn't there. I thought, what is she doing not having lunch for me? And before my mouth could spoil the moment, I looked up and just ahead was our living room, and Carol was literally bent over, and I knew that she was sobbing her eyes out. I thought she had been attacked. That's how serious it was. I ran over. I fell to my knees. I put my arms around her shoulder. I said, are you okay? And she just cried and cried in my arms. And then with tears running down her cheeks, I remember her looking at me and saying, Paul, we've got to do something. I said, what happened? She said, I never did find the drums today. She said, I went out. Do you know what I discovered, Paul? This is less than 2 miles from our home. It's in earshot from our home when people beat drums. She said, I just discovered that those villages are full of young kids. I found 6-year-olds looking after their 2-year-old siblings for 14 hours on their own as their parents go off great distance. One of the horrible legacies of the apartheid years in South Africa, and going off to find work. Nobody's there. They're not fed. She said, I found 8-year-olds looking after 2 or 3 of their younger brothers and sisters. We've got to do something. I said, well, of course. We found a pastor at a really basic church, just some corrugated iron over some raw poles. And we said, could he use the place? And we had an old beaten-out Land Rover that somebody had given us. We put water in there. I went up the valley to some of the farmers, and I got bananas that were past ripe and couldn't go to market. I said, will you give me some of those boxes? We piled about 3 or 4 of those big boxes in, and out we went. And do you know, the first morning there were 8 kids in that little church room, and Carol literally washed some of their hair for the first time in their lives. We would feed them bananas. Some of them were so hungry, they would eat the bananas without even taking the peels off. The next day, there were about 16 or 17. The next day, there were over 30. By the Friday of that week, Carol had 180 kids who she cared for every day, exhaustingly. We've met some of those kids now. They're adults. Some of them are sitting in local parliament, key leaders. But it all began with just that simple, heartfelt cry with tear-stained eyes. We got to do something. And the rest of the story's in the book if you want to read. I want to say to you, friends, in Crete, Nebraska, this lovely church, if you really want to understand Jesus and see him fulfill all of his promises for your life, it's as simple as this. Do something. Do something. God helping you, God helping us, we will live out his kingdom here, the side of eternity. Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed speaking to you. You've been so attentive. Just give me the opportunity of praying briefly before I finish. Father, I thank you so much for good people who have given time on a Sunday morning to hear your word, to be challenged by truth, and to respond appropriately. And I commit this good church and its leadership to you. Pray that you'd help us to understand that you love lost people, that you're committed to people who need dignity restored to their lives. Help us to understand these things, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.